Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour we'll visit a Lustron home. The prefabricated structures became popular after World War II, and there are many still standing today. We'll hear from a reporter who got an up-close look at migration by going to Colombia, what he learned. We'll also have the latest on bird flu and the concerns it may pose to humans. The director of the Illinois chapter of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention talks about some trends and what the state is doing to combat the problem. A climate change experiment is underway involving trees in different states, including Illinois. It could provide information about forests in the future. And we'll head to a small town that has become an arcade destination. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. What's your dream home? Well, for a lot of people these days, the answer is something I can afford. 75 years ago, it was this type of demand for starter housing that led to the creation of the Lustron House. The tiny prefab homes can still be found scattered throughout neighborhoods in the Midwest. What made them so popular is what makes them so easy to spot. They're made completely of pastel enameled steel panels. Cindy and Larry Mine opened their doors to showcase their quirky metal home in Mount Morris. Rockford architect Ashley Sarver and Lustron home expert Val Olofsson tagged along.
So you build your slab, then a big semi would pull up to your property. You'd be handed a book on how to put your Lustron together.
Okay.
And then you'd put it together.
And how long would it take, most people?
The record for putting the Lustron together is 39 hours.
39 hours.
So
what would average, what would it take me, like, how many months?
A couple of weeks. And everything that you needed for the house was on that truck. The windows, the interior, the HVAC system, which is one of their bad designs. One of their interesting designs was a dishwasher that converted to a clothes washer.
Interesting.
Ooh. Damn, I don't have one.
It's really interesting because everything is enameled steel, from the roof to the walls. Now, the exterior, as you can see, are squares. But on the interior, it's still enameled steel, but it's vertical panels. So if you want to hang art, you use magnets.
You could see that.
You guys have magnets in there? Oh, okay.
Yeah. And so you never have to paint your house.
Yeah.
You could take a hose, wash it down.
You can't do that inside.
And how long have you been living here in the Lustron?
We've been here for 7 years, and overall we're extremely happy because we're senior citizens. It's one level. There's no steps. One of the negative things is the storage is a little hard to come by here, so you'll see a lot of science stuff sitting out. But that's how we live.
Mm-hmm. Well, you usually do not see a lot of changes or modifications with the Lustron. Okay. Because, I mean, literally it's put together like a puzzle.
Uh-huh.
You know, each piece fits together. So by making a modification, then it'll snowball.
Overall, the concept of the house is excellent.
Oh, yeah.
It's just, would like to be able to insulate it just a little bit better. And wish it didn't cost so much to replace the windows.
The whole conversation is kind of coming back up again about prefabricated homes or modular homes, because we have the same issue that we had basically after World War II, where there's a housing shortage and it's too expensive to build them kind of the normal way. So we're looking at all these ways that you can either prefabricate or modular, you know, construct it mostly somewhere else and then just bring it on site again.
Yeah, it's been a really neat thing living in it. It's been a hoot. And like I say, when we go in, you'll see the pictures on the wall, everything. We got a lot of stuff hanging on the walls.
Well, can we take a look?
Sure, sure.
We love it.
So, but as you can see, like these lovely built-ins that were all part of the original design.
So this shelving was included, yeah.
Okay.
We found out one other thing that for cleaning purposes, alcohol is by far the best.
I do have to drink when I'm cleaning too.
You don't want to drink this alcohol.
Oh.
So overall, though, you're happy here. Like the house
By far. You know, it's, like I said, the few little quirky things, but it's really nice. It's a good starter home. I think I heard somebody saying that at the beginning. It's a good starter home, and it's a good finishing home. It's a good home to, for two old people like us.
Cindy and Larry Mine showing off their Lustron home in Mount Morris. If you want to know about Lustron homes near you, you can find a map. A link is at our show page. The H5N1 virus, or bird flu, was found in cows for the first time ever this year, and that's caused concern that infected cows mean the virus could have more opportunities to cross over into humans. It's also raised concerns about milk safety. A couple of months ago, the FDA said that commercial milk is safe because the pasteurization process kills any living virus. Now some scientists are saying there's evidence pasteurization may not be as foolproof as we hope. Side Effects Public Media's community engagement specialist Lizzie McGreevy spoke with the health reporter Ben Thorpe about the latest research.
So Ben, can you start off by talking about a recent letter to the New England Journal of Medicine, which found that some virus could be surviving the pasteurization process? What is happening there?
Yeah, so I think it's important to underline up front that this is an experiment conducted in a laboratory setting. Scientists I spoke to about this letter said, hey, we don't know how replicable something like this is going to be outside of the lab. But the gist is this. Researchers spiked raw milk with high levels of H5N1 virus and then put it through two different pasteurization processes. One method involved heating up milk to 63 degrees Celsius for 30 minutes. The other method was just 15 seconds at 72 degrees Celsius. I do think it's also worth noting that according to the International Dairy Foods Association, that 15-second pasteurization process is the most common process.
Okay, Ben, I love to know about the science of pasteurization as much as the next gal, but why do we need to know the different methods of pasteurization?
Well, okay, what researchers found is that that 15-second method still showed detectable levels of virus in milk. In fact, researchers say that there was still detectable virus up even to 20 seconds at 72 degrees. That means that there's a chance even after the pasteurization process, some live virus could be surviving. Okay, but again, and I'm putting every caveat in the book here, we don't know how those lab tests might translate into the real world. And I think it's also worth saying that the Food and Drug Administration has continued to affirm the safety of retail milk. The FDA sampled milk earlier this year, and while they did find evidence of H5N1 in retail milk, there was no live virus found.
Okay, love all the caveats, but that still sounds concerning to me. What's next?
So experts behind the letter say they want more research into H5N1 in dairy production. They want to see whether their experiments are replicable. There's so much that we don't know about this virus right now, including what dose could infect humans through drinking it. I spoke with Dr. Amish Adalja, a senior scholar at Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. He says he's not particularly worried about what researchers are seeing in a laboratory setting.
I think it's good information to have to understand the characteristics of pasteurization with this particular virus. But the bigger threat to me comes from unpasteurized milk.
More broadly, though, Adalja says there isn't enough being done to track the virus and understand how widespread infections of cows and people really are.
I don't believe that this strain of H5N1 is going to be the strain of avian influenza that causes a pandemic. However, it is a very good trial run that we're failing in.
One last thing. The FDA is trying to reduce the sale of raw milk. The department put out a letter earlier this month underlining that while the FDA does not approve the sale of raw milk for human consumption, some states do. Their message was basically, hey, help us communicate to people that during the midst of this outbreak is maybe not the time to be drinking raw milk. They also called on states that permit the sale of raw milk to use regulatory authorities to try and stop some of those sales, especially in areas where infected herds have been identified.
Well, this is all great information. Thank you, Ben, for keeping us up to date on H5N1. And I'm sure we'll be talking about it soon.
Well, hopefully not too soon.
Yes.
That's Side Effects Public Media's Lizzie McGreevy. She was speaking with health reporter Ben Thorpe. Side Effects is a health reporting collaboration of NPR member stations across the Midwest. Over the past 2 years, the city of Chicago has struggled to care for destitute migrants arriving from the southern border. The majority, around 30,000, are from Venezuela, a South American country whose economy has collapsed. But the number of Venezuelans in Chicago hardly compares to how many have migrated over the past decade to neighboring Colombia. Bogota alone, the capital, has received more than 600,000. Chip Mitchell of member station WBEZ flew to Colombia. He spent 2 weeks there to see how that country is handling the influx. Mel Ballara spoke with him about what he learned.
Chip, you were in Colombia not only because so many Venezuelans have moved there, Colombia also stands out for rolling out the welcome mat for them. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's one of the world's biggest migrant amnesties. Colombia, in just the last few years, has legalized the status of almost 2 million Venezuelans.
Well, we want to hear how that's gone and how much Colombia has integrated the Venezuelans into Colombian society. But do us a favor, let's take a step back first. What has driven so many Venezuelans to leave their country?
Well, the earliest Venezuelan emigres a couple decades ago tended to be high-skilled and relatively well-off. So, for example, political opponents of leftist President Hugo Chavez, thousands of striking oil workers that he fired. And then in 2013, Chavez died and Vice President Nicolas Maduro took over. The next year, a big drop in oil prices led Venezuela to slash public spending. So we have a lot of middle-class Venezuelans leaving at that point. By 2015, there were food shortages. In Bogota, I sat down with Sergio Guzman. He's a political risk consultant.
That really was the start of a new phase in Venezuelan migration to Colombia. It was both the poor and the destitute classes of Venezuela coming to our country, both as a transit point to another place where they had family or friends who had migrated, Peru, Ecuador, Chile, or up to the United States North. But some of them also found a home here.
Yeah, since 2014, in fact, about 3 million Venezuelans have moved to Colombia. Melba, that's about four times the number here in the United States.
And, you know, on the left, there has been a talking point that what caused Venezuela's crisis was a U.S. economic blockade. What did you find out about that?
Yeah, the Obama administration imposed sanctions on President Maduro and individuals tied to him. Trump comes in and sets up broad sanctions against, for example, doing business with the state oil company. That's Venezuela's economic engine. When I spoke with experts in Bogota, they pointed out, though, that those broad sanctions came after Venezuela's economy was already in free fall. So the U.S. doesn't deserve all the blame for the crisis. But Venezuelan sociologist Ligia Bolivar says the economic blockade did spread chaos.
An increasing of the illegal economies, drugs, minerals. Whenever you have an illegal economy, you also have armed groups. You have a country that's impossible to govern, impossible to handle.
Chip, you and Chicago Sun-Times photographer Anthony Vasquez went to some of the poorest parts of Bogota to actually talk with Venezuelan migrants. What did they say drove them from their country?
Well, they all tied it to the economic crisis. One migrant we visited, her name's Asnady Vega. She's 39. Until a few years ago, she and her husband were raising their three kids in northwestern Venezuela. They both worked in the local city hall. So Asnady says she coordinated a legal office. He worked in IT. Both were earning two or three times Venezuela's minimum wage. They had a house with three bedrooms, two bathrooms, a car, and a motorcycle, Melba.
Sounds like they were doing pretty well in Venezuela. What drove them out?
Well, Asnady says it was hyperinflation. It just got harder and harder to feed and clothe their kids. She says they were living on ground corn and getting skinny. In 2017, her husband left for Colombia to find work that paid currency that held its value. Asnady tried to stick it out with their kids in Venezuela, but she says the last straw was their son's shoes, the pair he wore to school. It was the only pair he had. They wore out.
La razón fundamental fue un día cuando precisamente mi hijo se le rompe unos zapatos y mi hijo mayor. Y yo no tenía para comprar el zapato. Y yo dije, no, no puedo, no puedo.
So Asnady says replacing the shoes would have meant the family going without food. And that was it. She sold their car to buy clothes for the kids. And she scraped up money for bus tickets to Colombia.
So Venezuelans are primarily fleeing an economic meltdown in their country. Tell us about how Colombia has responded, and how does it compare to the U.S.?
Well, Colombia is much poorer than the U.S. Its economy is less than 4% the size of the United States is, and its Venezuelan migrant population is much bigger. But the Colombian government has actually done a lot more for Venezuelans. It's set up a legalization program that now covers almost 2 million. They get a 10-year permit with paths into the formal labor market, the education and healthcare systems, and eventually even Colombian citizenship. Now, in the U.S., a lot of people resist this kind of thing. They're worried it'll drag down wages and hurt the economy. But in Colombia, wages in the formal labor market have not gone down because of the migrants. And the International Monetary Fund says integrating Venezuelan migrants into Colombia's formal labor market could expand the country's economy by almost 4% within just a few years.
That's so interesting. So is Colombia a model for Chicago and for the U.S.?
Well, there's actually been some backsliding on migrant integration over the last couple of years in Colombia under a new president. His name is Gustavo Petro. He's prioritized closer relations with Maduro, the Venezuelan president. And even though economists say integrating Venezuelans has helped the country, a lot of regular Colombians talk trash about Venezuelans. Now, these two nations, they share a language, they share religion and a long border. But a country as poor as Colombia, Melpa, doesn't have many resources. So there's resentment about the Venezuelans getting any.
And Chip, tell us what happened to the family of Asneidy Vega since they migrated to Colombia. Has life actually been easier for them?
Well, we met her at their home in southern Bogota. It's a part that sprawls up into the mountains. The newest settlements there, they're known as invasions. The roads are unpaved, the electricity is pirated, and there's no running water. And they're full of Venezuelans like Asneidy's family. Now, she and her husband have that legal status, but the only work they've been able to find has been unskilled and poorly paid. And to get to those jobs, they spend hours a day on buses. Their kids are home alone then. Their lifestyle is nothing like what they had in Venezuela before the economic collapse. But Melba, they are not starving, and the kids have shoes.
And they have hope for a better life. I've been speaking with WBEZ reporter Chip Mitchell. Thanks, Chip.
My pleasure.
This is Statewide. We have more to come. Stay with us. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Public transportation districts in southern Illinois are getting $1.8 million from the federal government to improve access to transit options. Mawa Iqbal has that story.
The money is meant to make it easier for riders traveling downstate to schedule trips across different transit districts. One of those is the Shawnee Mass Transit District, which has routes from the southern tip of the state to East St. Louis. Executive Director Mike Petrowski says their riders live in rural areas that are spread out and hard to get around.
There's no opportunity for employment, shopping, or just to get out of your area just to see the state. So we're hoping this, you know, if it helps just a few people, it's going to be great.
The transit districts serve the state's 20 southernmost counties. Petrowski says this is their first award going toward improving operations. I'm Mawa Iqbal.
Angela Cummings is the executive director of the Illinois chapter of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. She spoke with reporter Maureen McKinney about trends in suicide rates, the effects of the national 988 crisis hotline, and how to help prevent suicide.
I wonder if you can tell me about some of the most recent trends in the fight against suicide.
There had been a decrease in suicide in the years 2019 and 2020. And unfortunately, the pandemic happened, and there were some mental health ramifications to that, of course. And although we had been seeing a decline in the rate, we did see a U-turn. And so the rate has been climbing for the last several years. We only have preliminary data from the CDC right now for 2022, but for 2021, we did see another increase. And so obviously it's a huge concern to us. We like to see this as kind of a temporary blip because we do know that the efforts we were making were making a difference. We were getting a little bit of a reduction in the suicide rate prior to the pandemic. For Illinois, it's the 15th leading cause of death. It's overall, it's the third leading cause of death for people ages 10 to 24, which is definitely something that surprises and shocks a lot of people to hear that. It's also the third leading death for people ages 25 to 34. So it's definitely a leading cause of death for a large demographic in Illinois. Now, those people tend to be healthier and don't die by other causes as much, right? So in terms of real numbers, of course, we still have the largest number of people dying by suicide are men, and particularly middle-aged white men. So they make up really the bulk of suicides. That's nationally and in Illinois as well. The overall rate for 2021 was around 48,000 lives lost to suicide nationally. Yeah, it's the 11th leading cause of death. The rates are rising most sharply in our BIPOC communities. So those are, you know, Black, African-American, Hispanic, and Native American communities. So that is a cause of concern, obviously, for AFSP. And we really have doubled our efforts to try to do culturally relevant programming for these communities. And that's not just translating things into Spanish, for example, employing the input of community organizations, experts, people who can work with us to make sure that our programming is not just, again, translated or has like different graphics or different photographs, but is culturally relevant and addresses the, you know, the sort of pervasive cultural impacts that these types of people are facing in their own communities that maybe are unique to those communities. We have A Talk Saves Lives Latinx, which again has a different look and feel. It's in Spanish or in English, but a real different look and feel to really try to address, you know, the stressors that are happening in those communities. We just launched a Let's Saves Lives, which is kind of a version of Talk Saves Lives, but it is by and for the Black and African American community. And it is a longer program, and it really delves into the impact of systemic racism and overt racism and how that just impacts, you know, mental health in Black and African American communities. We do have an LGBTQ specific program, and we're just doing a lot of work on nationally in other chapters as well, doing a lot of work nationally with, you know, on reservations with Native American populations. Those rates are shockingly high. And as you can imagine, you know, it's just a really big problem with a lot of multifactorial reasons.
The 988 system as a suicide hotline recently took effect. Can you explain what that is and how it's working?
So we are still collecting data on that because 988 launched in July of 2022. And as I noted, the CDC lags behind quite a bit in their reporting because they're very thorough. And so the numbers that we have from the CDC currently are only complete for 2021. So there isn't really any way to, you know, match what the data that we've gathered from 988 to any rate data, right? Any direct effect on rates. But what we know is that it is massively successful in Illinois in terms of the number of people who are calling now, right? But I can tell you that Illinois used to be the worst state in terms of calls answered in state and in terms of the wait time. So only 20% of calls before 988 launched were answered in the state of Illinois. The rest of them were farmed out. They were kind of patched out to another nearby state or whoever could take the call. That was just because we didn't have the capacity in Illinois. That's not a great thing. When you don't reach the 988 center in your own state, you're not getting connected to your own local resources. Now, someone can help you in terms of stabilizing you and making sure that you're safe and trying to ascertain if you, where you are, if you have a plan, if you have a method, getting emergency services out to you and whatnot, but it's not ideal. Since 988 launched in Illinois, we've completely flipped that. And so now I think it's 82%, maybe even 84% of calls to 988 in Illinois are answered in state. They're answered by a 988 call center here in Illinois, and the wait time is less than 30 seconds, which is amazing. I once had to call 988 on behalf of someone who was confused and had called AFSP. We're not a crisis line. We don't do direct services, but I wasn't going to let them hang up with me. And I called on their behalf, and I got a message that said the wait time would be 80 minutes. I couldn't believe it. This was probably 2017, maybe something like that. So we didn't wait. We went to the crisis chat line, and online, and I started getting them connected that way, and that was a quicker response. But I have heard similar anecdotes from people over the years. So to say that 988 has been a game changer in Illinois is not hyperbole. It is absolutely changed everything. So 988 has three prongs to it. It's definitely the call centers, and those are wildly successful. We're so grateful that those are, you know, well-staffed and being answered and all of that. It's also someone to respond. So those are the mobile crisis units, and those are starting to roll out. And then it's somewhere to go. And that's the third prong of it. It's respite centers, because we know that the emergency room is a very bad place for people to go if they're experiencing a mental health crisis or a suicidal ideation, a suicidal crisis. If it's a suicide and attempt in progress, they have to go to the emergency room. But for someone who is just in a very severe crisis moment, they can often recover and faster and have better care if they can just go to a respite center and not have to go to the emergency room. So that's really the dream of 988. Someone to answer, someone to respond, and a place to go. And we're getting there. We're getting there.
What should you do or say if you suspect someone is suicidal?
Most of our education revolves around teaching people the warning signs. These are observable signs that anybody could notice in a friend or family member, a coworker, or themselves. And those warning signs are typically displayed in three main ways, and that's talk, behavior, and mood. People who are suicidal will honestly, quite frankly, talk about it. They may talk about things like feeling like they're a burden, or they're not sure they can go on. They may say that they're overwhelmed, that you would be better off without me, but they can sometimes joke about it too. And that can put people off and think that they're not serious. So we always say, if someone is mentioning suicide in any way, to take it seriously. Behavior, these are behaviors that are atypical for the person. They may be withdrawing from activities that they used to really enjoy. They may be giving away their possessions that we know that they really love dearly. They may be sleeping way too much. They may be not sleeping at all, things like that. And then, of course, mood. Mood is a little more subtle, but they could be really agitated. They may not always seem depressed. They may be more angry. This, we typically see this in men a lot, that they express suicidality more in a way that seems angry or aggressive. But any changes in talk, mood, or behavior is kind of a sign that you will want to reach out. So that's the next part of it. If you can recognize these warning signs, what should you do? And that is the basis of our campaign, which is called Talk Away the Dark. And Talk Away the Dark is a site that we developed that people can go to. We might worry that saying the wrong thing will make it worse, so we end up not saying anything, even though just a few kind words can make the difference in connecting someone to help or supporting someone who has experienced a suicide loss. And so it is tips and tools for approaching someone who you may be worried about or concerned about, how you ask directly, and you always want to ask directly. We don't want to beat around the bush. We don't want to say vague things like, is everything okay? Are you thinking of hurting yourself? When a person has reached a suicidal crisis, they kind of think they've found an answer. They think they've made a plan and they've got it figured out. And so these kind of vague questions don't get to the heart of it. They may say, no, I'm fine. I've got it figured out. I feel better now. And they may be feeling better in that moment because they think they've figured it out.
What should you say to someone who you recognize as perhaps being suicidal?
Ask directly. You can say things like, I've noticed changes in you recently. I'm very concerned about you. Are you considering suicide? Have you thought about killing yourself? Now, saying those things out loud seems so awkward for so many people. It even seems awkward for me. And I've probably said this dozens of times, maybe hundreds of times. I've told this advice to people. It does seem awkward, but you really have to just get past that awkward moment and be direct. What data has shown when we've interviewed people who have been in this crisis moment and someone has asked them directly, what has been reported back is that when someone asks directly, it's like a weight lifted off of their shoulders. They don't have to be vague themselves. Someone gets it. They can just say, yes, actually, it has become that bad. I have thought of that. It has entered my mind. And it's just like a release to them. That's most people report that when they've been asked directly. Now, you will potentially run up against someone who will get angry with you and say, no, I would never think about doing that. I would never consider that. How dare you? We always say, you know, that's a risk that you're going to take as a friend reaching out, and it's a risk worth taking. And when the person's mental health is better and their suicidal ideation kind of subsides and they get to feeling better, they now know that you're a safe person. You've asked that question, and more often than not, they're going to realize that you are acting out of, you know, care, kindness, concern, and they'll know that if they ever do need to reach out for help, that you are a person who understands, is non-judgmental, and it is a safe space.
Angela Cummings, the executive director of the Illinois chapter of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. She spoke with Maureen McKinney. For years, a Northwestern University psychologist has researched how people see their own prejudices toward different social groups. Now she's released a study that shows what happens when white parents talk to their school-age children about anti-black racism. Esther Yunji King takes us to her lab.
Sylvia Perry brought white parents and their 8 to 12-year-old children into the lab to discuss kid-appropriate situations dealing with prejudice and racism. The associate professor measured whether those talks had any effects on families' racial biases. The answer was a resounding yes.
An overwhelming majority of them, their data points are showing a reduction. It's a very large effect.
The experiments start with the white parent-child duo taking a long-standing implicit bias test. It has subjects linking positive and negative words with images of black and white people. Now, after that test, that's where Perry's videos and discussions come in. And then the families take the implicit bias test again. On a recent afternoon, I went to the Northwestern campus in Evanston. Perry had found a new mother-daughter duo willing to go through the exercise. Jennifer Tackett of Evanston and her 10-year-old daughter, Coco.
Hi.
Hi, you met Jennifer.
Hi.
This is Jennifer.
Nice to meet you. What's your name?
Coco. Okay, are you guys all set to go in? Okay, let me take you into the lab.
Perry gives them some instructions.
So you're going to watch some brief videos about kids interacting with one another. Each of these videos comes with either a prompt or some questions for you to talk out loud about.
She leaves the lab and observes next door. The videos are brief animations of black and white kids interacting with each other. A narrator describes what's happening. Take a listen.
Tom feels uncomfortable around black people. The other day, when he was interacting with Adam, he felt nervous.
The video stops, and Coco and her mother start to talk.
That's kind of racist, but not really.
Yeah?
It's like, yeah.
Well, let's look at the questions. Do you think there's something wrong with Tom's behavior?
I mean, I don't think so. It's not like he's saying, like, I don't want to work with you because you're dumb and because you're black.
Tackett gently pushes back.
So you're saying it's not as bad as really bad things, but don't you think that it's still a problem?
Yeah, yeah.
To act uncomfortable around someone because of the color of their skin?
Yeah, yeah.
How do you think Tom's behavior made Adam feel?
Maybe a little confused, like, what did I do? Like,
yeah.
What did he do? Or, like, maybe, like, sad or, like, kind of mad.
Yeah.
The scenarios range from two friends happily riding the bus together to subtle situations like the one just now to a white child deliberately kicking a ball at a black classmate. The experiment goes for about 20 minutes. After Tackett and her daughter leave, Perry points out a key finding in her study. The greatest reductions in bias came when parents and kids talked about the more subtle forms of prejudice.
We know that by the age of 3, white children are starting to develop these negative attitudes toward black children, and that by age 8, a majority of children of color are reporting that they have experienced discrimination.
Going forward, Perry plans to expand the research. She wants to see how people's neighborhoods and friendships can affect children's racial biases. She also wants to open the study up to include other racial groups. For Perry, the bottom line is this. Kids are not colorblind. And if parents say they want to raise empathetic children who value equality, her research shows race-conscious conversations can help with that. Esther Yunji Kang, WBEZ News.
Still ahead on Statewide, a small town has become an arcade destination. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Still on the way, we'll talk with a man whose passion for arcade games is helping revitalize a small town. But first, an organization at Northern Illinois University is giving black nursing students a safe space. Yvonne Booz tells us more.
And that's where we, like, you know, study at. They have tutoring down there as well.
Paris Ware proudly shows off the building that houses the NIU's nursing program. It is a part of the Wellness and Literacy Center at 3100 Sycamore Road in DeKalb. Ware is the current president of the Black Student Nurse Organization at the school. Kayla Brooks, who has since graduated, founded the group last year with the help of clinical instructor Rhoda Jefferson. Ware is a fifth-track nursing student. She says starting the nursing program was hard for her. She was adopted by her grandmother, who died prior to the beginning of the program. At the time, Ware says she was still grieving.
So those first three exams that I took, back to back to back, I failed them. I was just really, like, going through so much, having to work overnights, come to class 3 days a week, working 4 or 5 overnight shifts, still having bills. Like, it was a lot for me.
She says the Black Student Nurse Organization, BSNO as she calls it, offers study tables that will help students who need the help like she did when she first began. She explains that the group serves as a networking platform, and it also allows the students to have conversations that may not happen in other scenarios.
I have heard some stories where, you know, there are, like, black nurses who have been told to, you know, like, I don't want that nurse in here because she's black. I have heard a couple of stories, not saying it's all, because it's not.
She says some members of the group feel like they now have a voice. Ware mentions that before the organization, some students would not speak up in class. She also says many of them feel that they have to code switch. Code switching is the act of changing one's cultural identity based on the environment that they are in. This could include changing the way one dresses, talks, or even their behavior. Often, this is done to make other cultures feel more comfortable.
Coming into the nursing program, I did have a lot of trouble with that. I did. It was so different from just me being who I am from a young girl to now have to walk a certain way or, like, talk a certain way, to not be stereotyped as another ghetto black girl from Chicago.
Ware says some of the black students come from high schools that are predominantly black, and now they have to try to fit in at a primarily white institution. She says this will help prepare them when they are in their careers. But while at school, the organization gives them a safe space, a place where they can be themselves.
What is better than having friends who can relate to what you're going through? We're all having financial issues. We're all having issues maybe with our car. And, you know, it's hard trying not to eat fast food and out. Maybe we can, you know, put our money together and create a meal.
Ware says before BSNO, she didn't realize how many black students were in the program because the schedules are not similar, but this organization is bringing them together.
BSNO, it literally just means, like, the world to me to be able to share my story and also other fifth trackers and basically tell them, like, you will not be that 11% of black nurses that we have out in this world. You can be more than that. You're just more than a number.
Ware is on track to graduate this May. She says when she's gone, she wants this safe space and the people in it to continue to flourish. I'm Yvonne Booz.
An experiment is underway involving trees. Three identical gardens across Illinois, Minnesota, and Oklahoma are growing thousands of bur oaks. Scientists want to know how the oaks will respond to different climates and how that could affect forests in the future. Juan Pablo Ramirez-Franco has the story.
At the Morton Arboretum in suburban Lyle, Andrew Hipp jumps off a golf cart deep inside a part of the botanic garden that's off limits to the public and dedicated to just research.
We're here! So welcome to the garden. This is our experiment.
Hipp is a senior scientist at the Arboretum. On this rainy, muddy day, he's showing me one part of a multi-state investigation funded by the National Science Foundation for 5 years.
There are 1,000 oaks planted experimentally.
Oaks dominate North American forests. They account for something like 30% of American forests, and even more so east of the Mississippi, which means that this single group of trees provides a kind of scaffolding, critical for ecosystem services, for diversity of other life forms, for pulling carbon out of the atmosphere. Learning how the bur oak responds to a warming planet will have profound implications for what humanity does next to preserve them.
This study can give us a good idea of how the most foundational species of our forests are going to evolve as conditions change. And with the evolution of the oaks, with the migration of the oaks, those will shape the composition of the entire forest in our region.
That's why in 2021, the Arboretum seeded its garden with saplings from Illinois, Minnesota, and Oklahoma. At the exact same time, hundreds of miles away, identical gardens were planted in Minnesota and Oklahoma.
Because if it turns out that oaks are strongly adapted to their local environment, that means they've had potentially thousands of years to evolve gene combinations that may prove advantageous in the future as climates change.
The thinking goes that the Oklahoma trees should be adapted to the droughts. The northern Minnesota trees should be adapted to freezing conditions. And as things start to heat up, and the growing range of these bur oaks retreats northward, these adaptations are more important than ever.
In terms of trees, they are less nimble than we are, and they can't go get air conditioning. So we're trying to understand how they are going to perform in future climates.
That's Janine Cavender-Bears. She's an evolutionary ecologist at the University of Minnesota, and she designed this experiment. Across the three gardens, Cavender-Bears says that some overall results are becoming increasingly clear at the drier, hotter, southernmost range of the experiment.
Each population has the highest survival in its home site.
At the Oklahoma garden, the Minnesota and Illinois trees aren't doing well there so far. And so it may be the case that the southern range limit is going to become too hot and too dry for the bur oak to persist. Cavender-Bears says that that may mean moving those oaks from Oklahoma northward to help its northern cousins adapt to changing climates.
Our species cannot afford to let our forests die. We're going to have to manage them. So in a warming world, how do we maintain healthy forests? We need trees that are adapted, that have the right genes, that are adapted to the environments of the future.
Back at Morton Arboretum, Hip says whether the oaks will need a helping hand is still very much in the air. But it's something scientists need to know.
When we lose those, we've lost this opportunity to solve problems that we can't even predict in the future. So every tree is a warehouse of potential solutions to evolutionary problems.
And in a warming world, maybe climate problems. Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco, WBEZ News.
You might not realize the small town of McLean in central Illinois is an arcade mecca. Arcadia is an arcade and pinball emporium taking up much of the downtown in the community of 750 people. Owner John Yates has made the business into a way to earn passive income in what was already a successful career in buying, restoring, and selling arcade games. Lauren Warnicki stopped by.
Are you ready to
As long as God gives me breath, I am going to keep adding arcade attractions to McLean until I either die or it's like just a complete arcade city, you know, a mecca. So yeah, we're working on our fourth building for arcade stuff, and it's going to be our biggest, grandest venture. It's actually the building that I've used as a warehouse for 30 years. Hence, that's one of the problems with restoring it is it's full of games. It's got like 800 games in it. And so it's kind of hard to renovate a building full of equipment, but that's what we're doing. And we're hoping to open that sometime this year.
Now is that Arcadia Unlimited that I heard about?
Yes, that is going to be Arcadia Unlimited. And that's, I mean, if you want to get into the nuts and bolts, right now we are like a traditional arcade, like the old days where you come in and you drop quarters in games. But every other classic arcade in the country, almost every other one, is operated where you pay a fee at the door and then everything's on free play and you can stay all day. But I've been trying to recreate the experience that I had as a kid, and that was not the experience I had as a kid. But I've had enough people say to me, why don't you have a free play arcade? And I don't want to ruin what I've got here. So I decided, okay, well, I'll just add that. And that way, when people come down there, they'll have a choice. If they want to stay all day and play for free, then pay at the door at Arcadia Unlimited. if they just want to spend $2 or $3 and drop quarters in a few games, then come into Arcadia.
I would love to just hear you talk about what most scratches the itch. Is it the restoration of these old machines, seeing them come to life? Is it seeing people in here, you know, playing them? Or why do you do it? You've clearly committed your life to this.
Yeah. It's a good question. There's actually a lot of facets of it that I really, really like. I grew up playing Monopoly as a kid, and I've always been an entrepreneur since I was in grade school. And I liked the business aspect of the amusement business. For years, that's what really I thought was cool, was the idea that you could take these games and you could put them out in another person's location. And then you collect the money out of them every month and you split the proceeds with that guy. And the more of them you get out, it just seemed like this brilliant way to make money without doing very much work, you know? I loved that facet. Well, that facet of the business died before I even started. So another facet of the business I really love is the hunt. I go out all over the Midwest and further and go through barns and warehouses and basements looking for old vintage games. So that's... Of course, that's kind of dried up too. And then the third thing that really gets me excited is restoring the games. I've got a degree in electrical engineering, so I can fix just about anything. And I love buying games as is, broken, not even plugging them in, don't know what I've got. And then the day when I finally decide to get a game ready, I pull it out and plug it in for the first time and see what it's doing and try to troubleshoot it and see how fast I can figure out what's wrong and repair it. And that's really fun too.
Why did it need to be in McLean?
It definitely didn't. That's got to be a God's will thing, because I had never even been to McLean until the day I bought a building here. Back in 94, I was driving through town. I had just gotten married. I was looking for a place to live with my wife, and I'd never been to McLean, but I drove through looking for accounts to put games in, and I stumbled on this downtown building that had an apartment. It was being renovated, apartment upstairs, shop downstairs. The owner was there working on it, and we just worked out a deal on the spot for it. And then as soon as I got here, I really kind of fell in love with the town. It's like a Mayberry. It was a dry town. I mean, I'm an old-fashioned, conservative, traditional guy. I love the fact that it was a dry town. I don't drink, you know. I'm like a kid from 100 years ago. I just love the simple things. And this is such a simple town. I hope nobody's offended by me saying that. People are nice, you know, you wave and smile and say hi to everybody. Everybody's your friend. So yeah, and I just started buying all the other buildings in the downtown, because Illinois is just filled with these kind of ghost towns. They're bedroom communities, and the houses are all fixed up nice, but the downtowns are just falling to shambles because there's no way to operate a viable business in any of them.
On the one hand, being in a town of 750 people, you have the capacity to kind of buy up the downtown and make it a game paradise, right? On the other hand, for the business to really work, people have to come from outside in. I imagine for game nuts, it has become a destination, you know, but how has it been kind of making sure it all works dollars and cents wise?
I never opened this place for the kids of McLean. The kids in these little towns have no interest in coming into my arcade. They don't have any money. They've got better games on their phones than I've got in here. You know, before I had the arcade, I had a pinball showroom here for about 10 years where I just sold pinballs at retail to the home. And it never hurt me that I was in McLean, because that was a unique enough item and a unique enough purchase that people would drive 200 miles if I had something nobody else had. So I learned from that, and I realized, well, if I put up a classic arcade here, it'll be the same thing. There's no other business like this within 100 miles. People are going to drive to it, and they do, but, you know, not enough. I could never get rich doing this. I would be far richer if I had just continued in the programming world with my engineering degree. I worked for a couple of startups. I did my own startup. I could make a killing as a programmer right now. In fact, my old partner, I can't even say what he's making, but it's seven figures.
Wow.
And I could be making that, but it's not about money for me. I mean, I've got a family. I'm real active in my church. I want to have the freedom to go where I want to go, when I want to go, and do what I want to do. I'm a one-man show, too. I could be a lot more successful if I hired a bunch of people and we could really grow this thing, but I'm just living the way that I enjoy.
Thank you.
visit to Arcadia in downtown McLean. Owner John Yates has also purchased a building in nearby Atlanta, Illinois, and plans to open an arcade in that space. Lauren Warnicki brought us that report. We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for being with us. Join us next week for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Find our show where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford, and Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.